Hi, everybody. It's Mary Lou Tyler. This week's guest, you're going to love Nick. He's a strategic customer service manager over at outreach.io. A lot of you know that we love outreach. Outreach is a, for lack of a better term, he'll explain it more, but it's a great follow-up tool that does a lot of that plate spinning for you and thinking for you so that basically you come into your office and you've got a nice little to-do list every day and it handles all that background virtual assistant type stuff really, really well to help us improve our follow-up, which is what our role is all about in trying to get more meetings. So I've asked Nick to come on the show today to talk about things that he's seeing out there since he's immersed in millions of records on a daily basis. He's like the analytics engine, I'm sure. And I've asked him to come on to talk about his role and to talk about some of the things he's seeing so that you guys are prepared when we enter 2019 and with all this regulation of what to do and how to maximize your return on effort. Nick, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you, Mary Lou. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me on your podcast. And you said it perfectly, kind of what outreach does and the space that we live in and what I work with. But would it be helpful for me to give you a little more context there?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Go ahead. Okay. It's all yours.
Yeah. So specifically outreach, the world that we live in is helping salespeople streamline their workflow. And so we found that salespeople today more than ever are inundated with non-selling related activities. And that's what we're really helping solve that problem is getting reps back to actually spending more time doing selling. So helping with the automated follow-up process, helping tell reps when they're supposed to follow up with the right type of message at the right time, and then making sure all of that information gets back to Salesforce. And when we started in the space, it was predominantly in the world of what we call sequences. So just helping you figure out when you're supposed to follow up and why and with what type of message. And we've since evolved into all customer facing teams. So your customer success managers, your renewals managers, your account executives. So, you know, our strong point is definitely in the prospecting space, but we're seeing a ton of all customer facing teams using outreach to help streamline the way that they're communicating with their customers.
Yeah, that's great. I like the way, you know, right now we are focused on prospecting. That is my area of expertise. But it is anyone who touches the potential customer, the prospect in this case, or the client, once they come on board and are in your family, you want to be able to keep that conversation going because we're all affected by that shiny object syndrome of, whoa, there's something over here I need to look at. So we want to keep them happy. We want to keep them engaged. We want to keep them loyal so that they are clients for a very long time. Now, you mentioned something that was really interesting to me, the right message at the right time. Can you elaborate on what that means for outreach?
Absolutely. Yeah. So when prospecting, there's a lot of different trigger events, if you would, that tell you when you're supposed to be engaging with your prospect. That might be found through an external source, such as something you found on someone's Twitter or their LinkedIn or maybe in their 10K. Or it might be the way that they're engaging with the content that you've sent out. So I guess if we talk about the first category, a lot of times in prospecting, we do a traditional type John Barrows, why you now type messaging where we find a trigger event about the company or about the individual that we're reaching out to. And that's how we start our introduction. So it's definitely timely in that regard. Sometimes we don't have that type of information though. So you might just have to go with the best that you have. You might know about the person's persona. You might understand what they do based on their LinkedIn, but you don't necessarily have a timely reason to reach out other than this just looks like the right type of person who would find benefit from what our organization does. Mm-hmm. So what we can do is we help surface other types of engagement activities or engagement or inputs, I guess, if you would. So, for example, when people are opening your emails or when they're clicking on links so that you can tell that this person is more interested and we can treat them differently. I think it's good to customize your emails for sure. But I also think that it's important to put forth effort with those people that are the most engaged. And that's a lot of what we help people with, is surfacing when people are engaged, so you can really focus on them at the right time. So as they're engaging back, as they're clicking on links, opening content, or engaging with the content that you sent to them, you can engage back in the right way.
Yeah. So it's morphed into building that relationship, that pre-conversation relationship, so that when you do get on the phone with them, or when you do schedule those meetings, there's this implied trust and rapport that you've already established prior to getting on the phone. So it is a warmer, quote unquote, conversation that you're going to have. The other thing that I love about what you guys do, we are all really great at sales conversation. That's why we're sales professionals. That's why we chose this field. The problem is not that we don't know how to have those conversations, but we don't get enough of them to get better and better. You know, as well as I do, time in the saddle, when you are doing something on a daily basis, you're going to get better and better and better at it. So you have the ability to help us have more of these conversations so that we can deploy the sales methodologies that are all out there scattered all over the place, and how to close and how to handle objections and all of that other thing. But we need more of those conversations in order to get better.
That's absolutely it. I couldn't have said it better myself. And I think what's really interesting too is that we're in a bit of a transition period. When I think about the way that this space has evolved in the last 2 years since I've been with Outreach, or even before then when I was in a sales role, we noticed that a lot of these tools came into the market, and we now are giving the power to the salesperson to get email volume out there and get call volume out there. And now we notice that the effectiveness of that, if you're not careful and you're not trying to fine tune that engine and get better and better content and better mm-hmm. messaging, engaging at the right time, it becomes less effective over time. There's more noise. We're trying to cut through that noise in order to engage. And so if you look, and we see this in our data as well, is that over a very long period of time, if you're not constantly improving, your reply rate will slowly get lower and lower and lower. So there's that constant iteration process. The way that we always say it internally is we want to help our customers become more efficient, which is that first portion that I was talking about, as well as more effective. And if you're not focusing on both, your effectiveness will just eventually gradually decline. So you have to make sure that you're focusing on not only getting enough volume out there, which is what you're talking about, getting enough at-bats, having enough conversations, but you're constantly refining that process so that you can become more effective as well.
Right. So it's an impact and effort. And we're constantly tweaking, adjusting, analyzing, iterating, improving, testing. And what's beautiful about these systems is that we're not sitting there using our very precious non-selling related time. You know, we are taking that time that used to be admin and popping it into this automated, technologically advanced thing so that we can then focus on what kind of conversation should I be having? What level of awareness are they at? What's the purchase intent if they're at this point in that journey? Where should I be focusing my conversation so that I can advance that person through my funnel and get them to an opportunity and then on to close, so that we're both hyper-engaged. We're both excited about moving forward because we've warmed them up enough so that they feel confident that they're going into this with good decisions that they can make along the way.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, you talk about also what I'm kind of hearing you say is you talk about creating this, you want your buyer to see you as a person, as a real person.
Right.
And that's why I think we've talked about this before. You can't just be solely reliant on email. And that's not because email can't be effective, but it's a lot harder for your buyer to see you as an individual, as the person that you actually are on the other side of that keyboard, when they only receive text emails from you. And that's why I think social selling is becoming increasingly more important, as well as making sure that you're on the phone. Actually, a perfect example of this, I hear there's always the debate as to whether or not I should leave voicemails or not leave voicemails. And a lot of times sales reps will say, oh man, well, you know, I shouldn't leave a voicemail because they're never going to call me back. Well, the purpose of the voicemail is to actually make you seem like more of a person. If they hear your voice, they know that you seem like you're a nice person or a good person, they're probably more likely to respond to your email or respond to one of your LinkedIn in-mail messages, because it's a lot easier to hit unsubscribe on an email than it is to reject a person when you see them as a person.
You know, we just did a little mini test in my class about a LinkedIn. This was a request to fill out a survey. And we did one of the requests. This was to a list where we're first level. So we're connected already in some fashion to the person we were placing the request. So there was a warm connection because we, at some point, connected to one another. We placed a request in a fashion that was more of ask. And then we replaced the request in a fashion that was more of permission-based. The ask, the direct ask, was sending them the link for the first response was like a 3%. When we did it where we were more personal and asked permission to send them the link if they wanted to fill it out for us, we got 17%.
Interesting.
It was really wild to see that. So there are some unwritten rules, even in social, that go even further into permission-based in some cases, not all, but the fact is we tested. We wanted to see, since we're connected to them, you'd think, hey, here's the link, go fill it out, you know, versus, hey, I've got this link. I think it'll be really helpful for you. A lot of your peers are filling it out. It'd be really great if you can do that, but I want to ask your permission to do that. So send me a reply, yes or no, if you want to do it, or no is fine too. And that was a big difference. So, yeah, you got to test a lot of this conversation. It's almost as if when you're going from channel to channel, email to phone to social to direct mail to fax, even in some cases, my clients still use that. You've got to think about the language that is going to be accepted in that medium. It's not the same across the board.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I work with a lot of customers who are trying to craft the perfect email. And one thing in that same realm that you're talking about is having a clear call to action. But a lot of times people confuse having a clear call to action with being overly pushy.
Yes.
And I don't think they're the same. And what I love about what you were just talking about is we can still have a very clear call to action. And our clear call to action is, do I have your permission to do X, Y, or Z?
Okay.
But a lot of times reps will say, well, I don't want to be too pushy. So I'm just going to send them an email that has all of these resources and all of these great things that they'll benefit from. But when I get an email like that, and you've got 15 links, and you're talking about all these things that you do great, or all of the value that you could potentially offer me, I get lost in that. I don't know what you want me to do, and I don't understand the purpose of an email as a buyer, right? And so I think you're spot on. I think it's contributing value within that email, and then making sure that they have a very clear call to action. And that could be something different than asking for a meeting. You don't always have to ask for a meeting in an email. It could be a referral,
no.
It could be just permission. It could be
it was a helpful
advice.
Document that I wanted to send to you, a should ask questions document. It culminates with all of the questions that may be spinning around in your head right now. So go click over there. My gift to you, no strings attached.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's really like that. And because we have these tools, we can afford to do that. We can string things out over the course of time. Take our ideal sales conversation as if we were sitting across the table from our ideal prospect and break that up into chunks of conversation and send it out over time. It's not any different. It's just because we have more records in a lot of cases, not always, but we have more records to work with. We can afford to spread it out. And also with tools like Outreach, we can segment those conversations. So we may have one conversation with a marketing person at the company and a completely different one going on with the sales operations people in their language, when they're ready to consume, but they're all running simultaneously. So we don't have to remember, okay, what did I send email? Yeah, what did I send to her on this date? That is all now offloaded, which allows you to focus, like you said, on perfecting your sales conversation and that conversation to advance people in the pipeline.
Yeah, that's absolutely it. One of my customers said it perfectly. They said it's a marathon, not a sprint. And then, and you often see salespeople do exactly that. They go and they cram 15 bullet points into their first email and go, these are all of the ways. This is value. I'm contributing value on this email. But the problem is that you've again made this so hard to consume that your buyer is going to read the first line and then just
glaze over
or unsubscribe or just it's a marathon, not a sprint. I like to put maybe one or two value adds in each email and space it out over time. And then the other thing that you talked about is having that multi-threaded conversation. Yeah. I think this is another area that we see a lot of people overlook. It's just a common oversight, I guess I would say, is a lot of times we've seen this trend of the account-based prospecting. And what a lot of people have interpreted that to be is, let me grab all of the people that could potentially be involved in a buying decision within this account, and let me hit them all with the same email. Right. I'm doing my research. I've looked at their 10K. I know what's relevant to their business, but that doesn't quite cut it. And the other thing, and I think if there's one thing that I mean, there's a lot of things I wish I could go back and tell my former SDR self, but I think if there is one thing that's coming to mind right now is the people that you're talking to, they talk to each other.
Yes.
So they do. If I send an email to 15 people within an organization and it's all the same email, chances are at least a couple of them are going to lean to each other and go, did this guy Nick just send you this exact same canned email? Yeah, we're not going to talk to this guy. Definitely not going to talk to this guy. Right. So
he's spamming me.
Yeah, that's exactly it. He's fishing for a meeting. You know, he sent all of us the exact same thing. So you're right that you need to have a different message for every different persona that you're going after. Right?
I mean, that's the ideal. You're going to start probably generic, but lower. What we used to do with predictable revenue is we used to say, look, grab three records from the company. It's okay to send them the same generic one. Start getting a sense of who's bubbling up first. And that's the first person to pull out and then create your own conversation canvas with that role.
Right.
Because a lot of times clients don't know, well, where do I start? Which role of my five roles is going to be the one I should spend time crafting a sequence for, because it could be a lot of work. It seems like a lot of work. It seems a bit daunting when you first get into this, but it's a nice way to chip away at the response and see who bubbles up first. Then they earn the right to have their own sequence and their own conversation path. And then eventually, though, yes, you want to get as segmented, as narrowed as possible, because that will affect the response rate.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think for those listening to this podcast that are early on in their prospecting days or are trying to figure out what the personas are that they should be going after, I think a great action or a great process to go through is look at the deals that you've closed. You know, if you're using Salesforce, go into Salesforce, figure out who is involved with those opportunities, who are your buyers, run a report on it, see what types of titles you have, and those could start to become the buckets for your personas. And then go talk to the salespeople that actually close those roles, or better yet, go talk to your CSMs or the people that are working with your customers. If you're trying to figure out what value that you drive for each one of these personas, go talk to them and ask them, you know, what kind of value are you getting from our product or service? And then and create those buckets and start with the biggest buckets first, right? You might start with more of a generic message and then pick off one or two personas, like you mentioned, and those start to become your persona-based messaging.
Now, another thing that we get confused about, and since you deal with millions of records over there, do we need to have content that goes with each email, or can we say, give ourselves a break and have dialogue in an email and every so often have a click through? Or what are you seeing as best practice in that? If I have let's pretend I have an 8 touch sequence over 32 business days, is content needed for that? And if so, how much?
You know, I don't think it's a perfect science, honestly. We don't track that data, and we try to, there's certain areas that we like to be prescriptive and there's others that we don't.
Okay.
One thing that we did find is that if, depending on what your call to action is, you'll really only want to have one. So if you're trying to book a meeting with someone, then you probably don't want to have a hyperlink in there as well, because what's going to happen is they're going to read your email, they're going to click on your hyperlink, and now they're not in their email anymore and they've forgotten what the call to action actually was. Hopefully they're rooting around on your website and doing a bunch of research. So what I would say is, don't do all one method. So don't ask for a meeting on every single email. And don't hyperlink to content every single time. I would test out. If you're using a tool like Outreach or any other tool that's helping you measure your reply rates on emails, you can actually compare them against each other and see which one's going to be better. We found that actually reply rates without links are better for that exact reason that I was mentioning, is because we're distracting somebody with a link and sending them elsewhere. But, and I shouldn't use distracting because it's not necessarily a bad thing, but just again, it's a marathon, not a sprint. So just know the purpose of this email two within my 10 email sequence is to give them some content. So my call to action here is URL. It's a piece of collateral for them.
Right.
Now the other thing that I love that I don't see people using that often are actually PS lines. So if you are going to kind of break the rule and have two call to actions, a PS line is a nice way to not completely distract somebody. So, hey, I'd love to book a meeting with you. How does your calendar look for a 15-minute call next Tuesday or Wednesday? PS, here's an article I think you should reference. So it's still really clear for them what you want them to do in the email, but there's just that little extra added bonus for them as well.
Yes, you must be an old soul then, because that's going back to the direct mail days where PSs, not all the time, but worked really well. I still use them in my emails, and I do a combination of help, 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 ask. So I am definitely, but I still put that predictable revenue email one occasionally in, which helps me hone in on the right person in case I'm in a department of 35 marketers and I'm trying to find the one person of those 35 who do what I want, to be able to sell them on. But I do have the help, 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 ask, a 3-to-1 ratio that I use, and I start my folks out on that pretty much. On the help, 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 we do sometimes add click through, or we put within the body, right in the body of a problem and how it was solved. So mm-hmm. we agitate them, we introduce the problem, we agitate them, and then we solve the problem. So we use a lot of persuasive copywriting techniques in the emails that I help clients design, and my students especially, to make sure that we try these different things out in an A-B split test type of environment. And the PS I found, and the Johnson box, which you probably, I don't know if you know what that is.
No.
Okay, that is a direct mail again, and it's drawing the eyeball. It's like a link. It's before they had links, but it has asterisks or a bar around. It's like a box, and inside the box is the material that you want them to look at. Your eyes naturally go to that spot. Uh-huh. So we test a lot of times to see, does a Johnson box inserted move them quickly through the email to our click-through or our pain point or our solving the pain point or whatever it is, the customer testimonial, whatever we want to throw in there. And chances are, in a lot of cases, it does well there as well.
That's interesting. See, I've learned something.
A lot of this is old school direct mail. That's where I came up from, the ranks, when you had to really think about, because it was hard dollar cost to send a letter with stamps and paper, that you needed to do a lot of planning. So I'm a real stickler for planning as much as possible, because executing is expensive and planning is not. That's my whole view.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, that's good.
So the other question I want to ask you before we go, because I know I'm taking a lot of your time here, is you have, I'm sure, in your head some of the statistics. I read an article that you wrote that just totally flipped my world around when we were talking about the follow-up sequences and how much. What kind of benchmarks can you share with the audience of what you're seeing? That, what, first of all, what the benchmark is, why is it relevant, why do you think it's important, and if there are any advice that you have to improve that, let us know.
Absolutely, yeah. So there's a couple. Let's start with just overall email stats on an individual email basis. So the first is, we see across our entire customer base that about a 30% open rate is fairly standard. Actually, funny story, I had a customer the other day. This was a couple months back, and he was using Outreach to send out all his emails. He came to me, he's completely perplexed. He goes, I just don't understand. We're getting a, I can't remember exactly what it was. He's like, we're getting a 30 or we're getting a 40% open rate. I go, yeah, what's the problem? He goes, well, everybody should be opening this email. I mean, why wouldn't they? Who doesn't open their emails? We should be getting 100% open rate. So I thought that was kind of funny. But yeah, so we're seeing about a 30%. 27 is specifically last time I pulled the data is what we're seeing for an individual email open rate. The next is reply rate. Now, the other thing too to keep in mind, I want to caveat this with all of these stats that I pulled are specifically for the outbound prospecting type motion. If you're a team that's primarily, I mean, I know that's what we're talking about here in general, but just keep in mind that if you're going to take these stats back to your CSM team, it's probably going to be very different.
Yes, because this is targeted outreach. This is not necessarily a blended inbound outbound, nor is it a referral system. It's targeted outreach where you're selecting the records that you want to go after.
Exactly. Yep. So, yeah, we're looking at about a 30% open rate. We see about a 3% reply rate. 3 to 4 is kind of the sweet spot on emails. Mm-hmm. And then bounce rates, obviously we want to keep those as low as possible. That's really going to be, a lot of that's going to be indicative of the data provider that you use, as well as just following good email deliverability best practices. And I could spend an entire session on what are good practices and what are bad practices when it comes to email deliverability. Mm-hmm. But we're seeing, if you can keep that below about a 3%, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And you want to work with, you know, if you got something drastically higher, you want to work with your data provider to figure out, you know, what can you get me some better data?
Yeah, what's going on? I did a case study in predictable revenue where we were comparing two list vendors against the other, and the bounce rates were 30% on one, and I think 3 to 5 on the other one, which meant I had a lot more time to deal with, because at the time we had to actually pull those records. We didn't have a marketing automation system yet to help us take those out. So there was a lot of admin time spent just managing the list and taking care of the list and cultivating new names, where if we had a good rate, then we wouldn't have to worry about that piece. It would replenish itself once the records were in incubation. We can then replenish. But in this case, if I lose 30%, I got to replenish as I go in order to make my numbers.
Exactly. Yeah. And one thing I wanted, just because I work with a lot of these data provider companies out there, mm-hmm. and if you go, or if anybody listening to this goes to them and say, well, Nick from Outreach says that we should be getting a 3%, that's not what I'm saying at all. It's 3% across all of your emails that you're sending. So if you're reaching out to a prospect and sending them hopefully 7 to 10 emails a piece, then that's going to dilute the bad data or the inaccurate data that you might be getting from your data providers. So definitely don't go to your data provider and ask for a 3% bounce rate. Otherwise, you're going to leave, because I don't think anybody can get close to that. I work with the best of the best. So
I bet. Yeah. Good. Good.
And then the other one that I think is really important to highlight is opt-out rate. I work with a lot of sales teams that are resistant at first to including unsubscribes within their emails. And I always feel like it's important to explain why it's critically important. Now, mm-hmm. we've talked about being in a now GDPR world where not only is it legally required, but if you don't allow somebody the option to opt out of your email, the first thing that they're going to start doing is marking you as junk. And this kind of gets into the email deliverability best practices. But if you get marked as junk enough, then that's going to ruin the reputation of your entire domain. It means that you're not going to ever be able to send them emails again, as well as your colleagues may never be able to send to them emails. So you want to watch out for that. The other problem too is that if you don't have an unsubscribe link, then you're probably going to get a high number of people that are responding saying unsubscribe. So when we're looking back at those reply rates, they're going to be artificially inflated. Mm-hmm. So you really want to watch out for that, because you might think you have a killer template that you're using or a killer sequence, and in fact, it's just a bunch of people telling you, don't email me again.
Yeah, never contact me again. Let's go back to the reply rate, just to make sure I understand, the audience understands, that 3 to 4-ish%, is that individual or is that across the sequence?
That's an individual email reply rate.
Okay. Yeah. And, so across the sequence, you can aggregate.
Yeah. So what I actually look at this, so I was going to come back to this. So the last piece is that if today you're not using a tool like Outreach or anything that's helping you automate this entire playbook or you're in all of your touch points, it's going to be hard for you to pull this data. But arguably, I think the most important number to look at is your overall sequence reply rate or your overall effectiveness of the campaign that you're running. So between all of the different touch points that we're having, so our phone, our email, our social, how effective are we at actually getting this prospect to respond to us? And what we see is a good baseline is around 12%.
12%. Okay. And is that matter whether it's blended, meaning multi-channel or email only? Do the rates change? Do you have that data to say, I have some clients who are very resistant of using the phone on the cold sequences. They want to do an email only, what we call wake up the chill campaign. So while they're sleeping, they're getting people to reply. I know that's not recommended, but do you have numbers for that type of campaign versus a blended phone, email, or multi-channel? Or is this 12 the multi-channel?
It's blended. So I don't have, because every organization's reply rate is going to differ.
So differ, yeah.
Right? Whether email or phone is more effective. You might have an abysmal email reply rate simply because your buyer is just not on email that often. That doesn't mean to leave email completely out, as well as vice versa. So like, for example, you look at us, we sell predominantly to salespeople. Are often at their phones, and sales leaders even are usually pretty accessible on their phones. So we actually get a pretty good phone response rate, and our email response rate is a little bit lower. So we look at almost a 10% answer rate on phone, and our email is lower, like in the 2% range. That might be completely flipped if you're selling to IT. But I think the nice thing about looking at about a 12% is that that's a good baseline, again, for you to kind of focus on between the two.
Yeah, and what we look for is baselines, because we know there's so many different situations. As Nick said before, the prospect persona and how they like to consume information and read or whatever they like to do is what drives how your blend looks and what your blend response rates are going to be. And there is a difference sometimes between IT, marketing, and sales. That's my sort of area, and they vary wildly depending on the persona. But I know that, so I know how to plan for that when I'm doing my blend, so that I have those conversations filling up the pipeline and there's no peaks and valleys. All of these things allow you to almost practically perfectly design your sequences so that you're not doing those peaks and valleys of trying to fill the funnel up. Especially towards end of quarter, if you're in all roles, like a lot of my folks are, you know, you're trying to close business. It's so hard to try to think about prospecting at the same time. When you have tools like this, you can turn it up, you know, amp it up a little bit and get that going. And that way you can still close business and have automation help you maybe more or less, depending on where you are in your cycle of sales.
Right.
So this has been such a great conversation. How do we get a hold of you to learn all that you've been learning so that we can get smarter too?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this has been really fun. Feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn. Again, it's just Nick Hart, NickHart. If you want to shoot me an email as well, I'll give you that. It's nick.hart@outreach.io. If you're curious about our product or just what we do as an organization, feel free to reach out. If you just want to network, do so as well. I always welcome it. Mary Lou, thank you so much for having me on your podcast.
My pleasure.
It's been so fun.
Yeah, it was really fun. And I will add, being an outreach user for years now, is there's a lot of tech training materials on their website, and you can go there whether or not you are an outreach user or not to start learning and understanding, especially since we're moving into these more sophisticated and strategic sequencing and cadences. There are a lot of things that these tools do now that are beyond what we thought ever could be possible. As Nick said, you know, they can halt the sequence so that you can send a direct mail. They can do all these weird things now that allow you to be in total control of your sales conversation, that pre-sales conversation. And as he said, they're taking it all the way into the pipeline. So nurture sequences when they're already clients, or maybe they're prospects waiting to come back in later. These are all areas of the pipeline, physical locations, where you can apply these sales conversation canvases to keep your prospects and clients engaged. Thanks again, Nick. Loved having you on the podcast, and take care.
All right. It was good chatting. Bye.